Our first letter today, Jeff Merrick, on this non-going postal Tuesday, comes from Scott Thursom. Scott Thursom is a guy who works in Detroit, Michigan, so he knows a thing or two about the Detroit Red Wings. May or may not have watched Game 3 of the Western Conference semifinals last night. He read my article detailing how the Blackhawks were robbed of a goal in Game 3, the play in which Andrew Shaw was in the crease but not touching Jimmy Howard and not necessarily obstructing Jimmy Howard, but the goal was waved off. And Scott Thurston believes that the rule to consider is 69.3. If an attacking player establishes a significant position within the goal crease so as to obstruct the goalkeeper's vision and impair his ability to defend his goal, and a goal is scored, the goal will be disallowed. For this purpose, a player, quote-unquote, establishes a significant position within the crease when, in the referee's judgment, his body, or a substantial portion thereof, is within the goal crease for more than an instantaneous period of time. In fairness, this could be the only close logical explanation for waving off the goal. Like, I can almost buy it, right, this explanation. It doesn't take into account that Carlo Koliakovo is the one who put Shaw in the crease, kind of kept him there. It also doesn't take into account that Shaw goes deeper into the crease, hockey porn, when Kindle bumps into him. Now, whether Bickle hits Kindle, whatever, Kindle hits Shaw, and Shaw goes deeper into the crease. Now, this is a fair assessment. If you wanted to make the argument that 69.3 applies to the situation, I guess I can buy it. But that's a goal. I mean, that's a goal. Let's not kid around. He didn't do anything to obstruct Howard on that play. And if he did, it was Howard's own defenseman that put him in that situation.
Correct. It was just a bad call. That's all it was. It was the wrong call. And it was a call that a lot of people will point to and say, that's exactly why we need a coach's challenge. For upon further review, the goal should have been allowed.
I would
That is a bullet in the coach's challenge chamber.
I think so too. But here's the thing, right? Like, I know it's a goal. You know it's a goal. NBC knew it was a goal. But as was quoted to me last night, chapter and verse by Red Wings fans, evidently the CBC panel, TSN's That's Hockey, no less an authority, Kerry Fraser, Mr. Game Management himself, all of these people said it wasn't a goal. So how are we to assume that the war room would overrule one of its officials to say that was a goal last night?
I don't know. Everyone thought that the latest suspension to Rafi Torres, pretty much everyone that you spoke to said it's a good hit and it doesn't warrant a suspension, other than the fact that it's Rafi Torres.
Yeah.
Right? So. I mean, we have seen these, inconsistencies. And to the point about game management, and a lot of people talked about this last night on Twitter, most notably you. I don't think that was a game management call.
Well, it was
like game management calls, like tripping in the neutral zone, or like a little tug or a little hook here.
Let's dial it back
for a second. That's not a game management call.
The game management argument was being made by Blackhawks fans and also by some Red Wings fans who believed that this was a give back for the missed cross check on Johan Franzen by Super Nintendo Jarmelson earlier in the sequence that led to the Patrick Kane goal. And that this goal being taken off the board for Chicago was some sort of comeuppance for the officiating crew being so egregious in not penalizing the cross check before the Kane goal. And I agree, that should have been a penalty. Absolutely, it should have been a penalty. Either a boarding or a cross check. But I agree. I mean, I don't think that that they're going to take a goal off the board because they missed a penalty. Game management occurs. We all know it does. But like you said, it's more in the case of this guy dove last period, so now I'm going to get him for a hooking call.
Yep.
For comeuppance. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. We owe you a call, not a goal. We owe you a call.
Right.
That's kind of the way that it's done.
So if I may, Jeff Merrick, to kick off today's program, and by the way, welcome to the Merrick vs. Rutschinski podcast. We're talking about Game 3 of the Detroit-Chicago series. A huge win for the Red Wings, by the way, beating a Chicago team that had owned Joe Louis Arena for the last 11 games and taking a 2-1 lead and looking very much like the Detroit Red Wings team that used to win playoff series like nobody's business. A couple of things about my friends, the Red Wings fans, if I may. First of all, a missed cross-check on a play that eventually leads to a goal. And by eventually, I mean takes a long, spectacular pass from Duncan Keith to connect to Patrick Kane to result in an amazing shot that then beats a goaltender who has a chance to save it and also beats defensemen that have a chance to stop the play, does not equal, I'm making the sign with my fingers, does not equal a goal being taken off the board. One missed call, there are several different dominoes that still need to fall in order for there to be a goal scored. In the other instance, a goal is scored and then taken away from a team. They're not the same. And don't equivocate the two, because if you do, you're an idiot. They're not the same.
It's true.
Okay,
it's,
thank you.
It's chalk and cheese. You're right.
Thank you for the validation. Secondly, we are all very aware that during his career, the late, great Tomas Holmstrom was penalized unfairly for goaltender interference on many occasions. In fact, if you read the goaltender interference rules and bylaws, they almost read like someone watched his game tape and said, we have to come up with reasons to penalize the guy. Now, that said, just because your guy used to get dinged unfairly for goalie interference doesn't mean that cosmically the goal should have been waved off last night. Okay? Just because I heard from all these Red Wings fans, ask Tomas Holmstrom what that's like. Well, sure, yeah, we all agree. That guy got jobbed all over the place by the officiating crew. It was like he had his own gravity, and goaltenders were flipping and flopping because he got caught in a gravitational pull. That said, that's a good goal last night, and I give a damn what happened to Tomas Holmstrom during his career.
But to the point about Tomas Holmstrom, too, and if you ask Tomas Holmstrom or Dino Cicerelli or Tim Kerr or whomever else made a career standing in front of the net and getting in front of goaltenders and, you know, tiptoeing through those tulips through the goal crease, that's the cost of doing business.
That's
you know
true.
That if you're going to score 200 goals like that, because, you know, let's face it, it is not an exact science, you're going to have a bunch called back, too.
Yeah.
Like if that's the way you're going to score goals, you know, little 2-foot goals, little 2-foot putts, goals that barely hit the back of the net, you're going to have to, you know, concede
Thank
to yourself,
you.
Okay, if this is how I'm going to score goals, you know what? I'm going to get a lot of these called back.
That's a really good point. And there's not enough of that recognition in hockey in many cases. For example, if you're a guy like Tomas Holmstrom who's going to make his living around the crease trying to score garbage goals like that, you're going to get you're going to get a good number taken off the board because you're going to interfere with the goaltender or you're going to whatever, you know. If you are Jonathan Quick and you come out of your crease with frequency to make saves, guess what? You might get bumped once in a while by guys who are nowhere even near your crease, but they're bumping you because you're coming out to make a save. If you're Rafi Torres and your whole gig is hitting people high because that's been your gig since you've come into the league, well, guess what? Sometimes you're going to get rung up for it because they don't allow it anymore. A little diversion here for a second, a little sidebar. I heard people defending Rafi Torres, specifically Boomer and Rob Higgins on the XM show the other day, defending Rafi Torres, saying, why on earth would Rafi Torres try to hit someone in the head? He knows what the stakes are. He knows what will happen to him. Well, God, how did he not know what was going to happen to him before he hit Kosa? How many educations does this guy need? How is that possibly an excuse for what Torres did? Because he knows this time they're really serious. Come on.
Wait, hang on. You thought Torres went after his head?
I think Torres hit him high.
I think Torres hit him in the shoulder, and the shoulder is close to the head when you're hunched over.
I think he hit him high. I think he went towards his head.
You're allowed to hit to the shoulder. That's high, right?
Well, I know, but the principal point of contact was still the head, sir. Didn't you watch from Brendan Shanahan?
I watched the video. And
you are
Shanahan
you were
mistaken. Said,
the initial point of contact with the shoulder, but the principal point of contact was the head. This was all very explicitly laid out by Brendan Shanahan, sir.
That's right. That was a nice little bit of wordsmithing, by the way, by the Department of Player Safety.
That was like when you're in high school and you have that one complete asshole teacher that when you screw up an assignment takes your face and buries it in it like a puppy in its own mess to say, well, then you got this wrong and you got this wrong. Here's why you got this wrong. Here are all the bad decisions you made on the quiz.
That was linguistic yoga. is what that is. Yeah. Well, the initial point of contact may have been the shoulder. However,
all right.
Oh, so what you're saying is then he hit the shoulder. It's you know what it's like? It's like when you hear an ad on television for detergent, and it says it leaves your glasses virtually spotless, which means there's still spots on them.
That's right.
Virtually spotless.
Effective 99% of the time. Now, in fairness, Andrew Shaw is a lot like Holmstrom in the sense that he does make his, you know, makes a good amount of his dough in the crease there. He kind of plays the same kind of game in some ways.
Sure.
So that said, we acknowledge that, but in this case, I don't think that he did anything illegal, and I think the goal should have counted. The third message I have for my friends in Detroit is this, and this kind of ties into our question of the day today. Just because someone believes that your team got an unfair break at the expense of another team, or just because someone believes that maybe, I don't know, you didn't deserve to have that moment that changed the momentum in the game and Datsyuk scores and then you go on to win, or maybe even something broader like someone picks against your team in a playoff series based on the available information, the stats, the recent history, your gut feeling. Just because someone does these things doesn't mean they hate your franchise. I don't hate the Red Wings. Merrick doesn't hate the Red Wings. Many of the people who pick Chicago in this series don't hate the Red Wings. It's okay. I'm going to speak slowly here for Detroit. It's okay to occasionally criticize the best franchise in the National Hockey League over the last two decades and not completely hate them, wish them ill, hope they fold. It's okay. There doesn't need to be extremes. Criticism's a good thing. It's a healthy thing. It doesn't mean that I want the Red Wings to get shipped to the KHL and we get Medelurg back. It doesn't mean that.
Wait a minute. We'd get Mike Keenan back in the NHL then.
Now, granted, there are some people who hate the Red Wings, and they want them to fail. Blackhawks fans, for example. The guy on Jersey Fouls this morning who has the Detroit Sucks Franken jersey with the black and the white. He probably hates Detroit. I don't hate Detroit. Do I hate the 3% of their tinfoil hat-wearing fans who shit all over me whenever I have the most benign criticism of the franchise, who ignore the fact that we suck off Ken Holland, Pavel Datsyuk, Nick Lidstrom, Henrik Zetterberg, even Todd Bertuzzi on the program and on the blog whenever we get a chance? Well, yeah, they bug me. But that doesn't mean I want their team to lose all the time. I've had Flyer fans tell me to F my mom at a game. But yet I still like the Flyers for some inexplicable reason. It may be self-loathing. So the lesson learned here, fans and friends and listeners, is I don't hate the Red Wings just because I think the call last night was abject bullshit and an embarrassment upon previous embarrassments for NHL officiating in these playoffs.
You know where you get that too, Wish? You get that when you do predictions. When you do predictions, you get that exact same feeling back, don't you?
Yeah. And what's funny about the whole... But, dude, you know what's the most hilarious... But, again, it's the most hilarious thing because what was the case 2 weeks ago with us, this very radio program, and Chicago fans? The Chicago fans thought we had it in for them because we weren't talking about the Blackhawks. Last night... I was trending in Chicago last night on Twitter because many Blackhawks fans were mentioning how wonderful it was that I was coming to their defense. So how do you like them apples?
They go, you can't win.
One day you're a chump and one day you're a champ in the eyes of the Blackhawks fans.
Yeah, you can't, honestly, you can't win. You can't win. But you know what? And this is part of the problem that I see with sports mentality right now. And everyone says, how can you not pick a team? How come you don't have a team? How come you don't have, skin in the game? To me, it's a lot healthier for my own sanity just to enjoy a hockey game. Because what sports produces, not unlike war, for example, it produces choose your side, dig in your heels, logic doesn't apply against us. It's everybody trying to do something bad to us. It's a George Bush with us or against us type vibe. That's what fandom is now in 2013. Don't you feel?
Yeah.
You dig it in, dig in deep, and take on all comers. And no matter what your team does, it can always be justified. But everyone is trying to do immeasurable harm to your organization. That's what it's become. Mm-hmm. Now, you may say that it's fun, and that's cool. Some people get off on that, Twitter wars and screaming at, rival teams. That might be part of the charge of being a sports fan. Us versus them, them versus, I understand it. That'd be part of the charge. It's just not for me.
Have to put some of the blame on the teams themselves. I mean, there's been a change at some point where it's no longer you're part of the pack, you're part of the fans. It's no longer you're the seventh man, as it were. Now you're part of the army. You're part of the sin's army. You're part of the devil's army. You're part of the army. You've been militarized.
Yeah.
You're a weapon. You know what? How do you not then take up the battle flag if you're part of the army? Look what those bastards are trying to do to our team. We call upon you, army, to get our back.
Or sends, or insert team X here, blank nation. That's another
That's
good
true
one.
Too. Yeah.
Right? How many times?
Part of the
nation. Leafs nation.
And what do you do if you're a proud member of a nation? You take up arms to defend your nation. So whether you're part of the army or part of the nation, you're going to have a militaristic view of your responsibilities as a fan. Obviously. Right?
Yeah.
Karen Douglas writes in, today's episode of Merrick vs. Wyszynski should be called Wyszynski Wears His Cranky Pants. That's probably accurate.
Yeah, you are a little bit angry today.
Hawks, Bears, Cubs writes in, yeah, but you clearly hate the Hawks, Turd Munch. That's to me. Turd Munch.
Mm, oh, okay. Yeah, that's a new one. That's kind of Beavis and
Butthead. The question of the day, in case you couldn't glean it, was who has the most paranoid fan base in the National Hockey League? Who wears the tightest tinfoil hats in the National Hockey League? And what's great about this question is that everybody once again believes they have the answer. Charles Marlowe writes in, how is this even a question? Hashtag Canucks. Right? Marcus White writes in, is this even a question? Of course it's Detroit, the fan base who invented the tinfoil hat. So everybody knows who it is, right? And the fact that you think it's might be yours or someone else's, I think, defines you as paranoid.
Are we going to find anyone that says my team is the most paranoid?
I hope so.
That team is, you know, so. What? I'm a fan of blank, but you know what?
I'll freely admit back in the day, back around 88, from 88 to about 92 or 93, I would have proudly said the Devils fans are the most paranoid. After the Koharski incident and the years afterwards where every time you saw the Devils get screwed on a call, you thought, oh, it's that fat bastard. Having those meetings before the season with the donuts in the back of the room and the coffee, telling his little zebra friends to screw the Devils because they made fun of him. Sure. Absolutely.
Here's the thing, guys.
Yes, sir.
Say whatever you want about the National Hockey League or how you feel about Gary Bettman. There's no Geppetto to Pinocchio relationship. Okay? There's the NHL doesn't want, isn't going to sort of rig the game so these teams win. Because it helps their bottom line, the way Alexander Ovechkin was musing after Game 7. Right? That doesn't happen.
No,
there's been no evidence other than circumstantial, a bad call here, too many power plays there. Like, do you know how much of a scandal that would be for the credibility of a professional sports organization? Basketball went through this with the one rogue referee.
Yeah, with Tim Donaghy?
Tim Donaghy.
Yeah.
Do you know how much of a scandal that would be? And do you think NHL has the wherewithal to do that, to potentially destroy their league, a $3 billion industry, which is doing just fine right now, thank you very much? Not a chance.
No, I agree.
No one's
I think
against,
something...
no one's trying to sack any team here.
It's too large of an undertaking. I do believe there are rogue elements in this league who've taken upon themselves to call the game as they'd like to see it play out. But as far as a grand league conspiracy to fix games, no, I agree with you, Merrick. I don't think it happens. It's too complicated. That's why I think you focus on something that's more easily manipulated, like ping pong balls in a ping pong ball machine.
You think the draft's manipulated?
Because all that takes is, you put a little weight on one. Maybe you just kind of paint one with lead paint or something.
Yeah,
and then that pops out.
Right.
And then you can kind of filter a player to a franchise that, I don't know, might have been bankrupt and almost relocating and needed to build a casino to keep it in Pittsburgh.
The hurts for Zoys a little bit.
The first year they had a draft lottery.
Depends.
You know, that kind of thing. It's kind of a weird thing, right?
Just luck, I guess. But you know what? Luck is something, though, which we've never talked about this in the podcast. Luck is something that not enough people give audience to. Like, right. Whether it's, you know, them winning the draft lottery, or, you know, a puck bouncing off a stick, going off a toe, going off a heel. Because analysts, people that talk about hockey, you can't form a narrative around luck. Like, there's no story. There's no discussion point when it's just luck. But don't you find a lot of sports, especially at the pro level, it's all about luck? It's about being healthy and being prepared and all those things that go into being a game. But isn't a lot of it luck?
It is. It is. But again, I hesitate to bring up luck because I know we have a lot of stat heads who listen to the show, and luck is something that has no home in advanced stats,
no.
I don't think. Or you can explain luck away. But anyways. All right, we are making Josh paranoid, our producer, so we must start the show.
I know.
Okay. Let's start the show.
Go ahead.
Correctly? No, start the show.
No.
Rightly?
Rightly?
Start the show.
No.
Start the show proper, shall we?
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
We're going to get corner offices out of this one for sure, Greg. Right away, your BS detector should go off. Why do I know this crap? What's wrong with me? Are you insane?
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
You and I are not quite that dissimilar.
La 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 la, hockey.
Seattle is playing excellent defense these days.
What does that even mean?
Debate hockey.
So much junior hockey knowledge in that big juicy brain.
Oh, yeah.
Pop culture.
See, I kind of look at our podcast here like Jazz Odyssey.
There's some bloggers that are great, that are entertaining, that are factual. It's fabulous.
Damn right, JD.
And more hockey.
Just what we need to shoot off the side of the barn. That's how I developed my wrist shot, shooting frozen cow patties in Lloydminster.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Merrick versus Wyshynski, huh? Hey, Paul Vogel writes in, do you think that Andrew Shaw being involved factored into the decision to call off the goal, considering he has been an undisciplined dope in this series, like Rafi Torres in the hitting? I actually think that there's probably a better chance of Andrew Shaw being identified by the officials as someone who could potentially interfere with the goaltender. I mean, we know
really?
That they talk about who dives and who doesn't. I don't think for a second there isn't a thought in the heads of the officials on the ice for this series that they know who's going to crash the crease and who won't. For sure.
So you think that if it's number 19 rather or 81 rather than 65, that's a good goal?
I think it's possible.
Hmm.
CJ Bear 71, Kristen Atlanta writes in, if the crowd had erupted with the "You Got Holmstrom'd" chant, it would have been freaking awesome. I completely agree.
That would have been good.
Jeff McCulloch, I totally agree with Wish. Even as a Wings fan, I choose the Hawks to win the series. I stopped going to Wings blogs just because they were too much of a tinfoil hat wearing soapbox. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Listen, that's the minority of Wings fans, and I don't want to paint with a broad brush because I think most of them aren't the us against the world, the NHL's out to get us.
Everybody hates
crowd.
Us.
I mean, I assume that a good majority of Wings fans do have access to. Next year's realignment, do have access to the location and time of next year's Winter Classic and NHL alumni games. I assume that they have these things at their disposal and know that the National Hockey League occasionally, despite what they really want to do, caters to the Detroit Red Wings. I don't know.
Did you find it strange last night on a different vibe with that game that Detroit was clearly the more physical team? Like not like, I mean, because Bickle was running around a little bit, Shaw was running around a little bit, but did you find, like, as far as precision hitting and being physical in this series, that it was advantage Hawks? Advantage Wings? Advantage
I was going to say, I think it was advantage Hawks early in the game. I think they came out hitting, but I think Detroit kind of took that over as the game went on. No, that's a surprise, definitely, in this series. And you get the feeling that Chicago's a little bit lost right now. And one of the reasons why is Zetterberg. I mean, Zetterberg is, for my money, one of the best playoff performers in the league, and
shutting down Taves,
ripping the heart out of the Chicago Blackhawks right now by shutting down Taves. I mean, it's akin to what Taves did in the previous series against Parise and Koivu, but now it's being done against the Hawks, and they don't have an answer for it. And this is
it's got to be
when you take. Go ahead.
I was gonna say it's got to be endlessly frustrating if you're Jonathan Taves, knowing every time you're on the ice, you look down the Detroit bench and 40 is jumping over.
Yeah. For sure. And
because you know what's coming.
Yeah, for sure. And when you do, when you take out Taves, what you do is you take away a guy who has scored more points on the road than he has at home in four consecutive seasons. You take away one of the best road performers in the league, in Jonathan Taves, in a situation where they need him to score in the Joe to be victorious. So it's been a great series for Detroit. I think it's going to continue. They've found another gear. We've seen them do it before, but we've not seen them do it without Nicholas Lidstrom on the ice. Joining us down the line, a man who always finds a second gear in the postseason because he is the preeminent voice in the Boston Bruins digital media. He is Joe Haggerty of CSN New England. Hello, Joe. What do you know?
What's going on, boys? Yeah, I haven't stabbed any beasts on camera, so I wouldn't say I'm the most preeminent voice all around. Until I make the stabbing motion with the dagger, I'm still working up to that title. The king of all Bruins media is still and always will be Jack Edwards, I think.
This is true.
Yeah.
This is very true.
He's willing to face the bayonets. He doesn't care. That's just the kind of guy that Jack is. Hey, the big question on the box.
Damn the torpedoes and stab the beast, Wish. That's what it's all about.
That's it. That's his dance. Hey, Hags, here's a wide brush question. Take it however you see fit. What's happening with the Bruins defense?
For tonight, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Seidenberg doesn't look like he's going to play. He was out late and during morning skate, an optional morning skate. Claude Julien said he's probably not going to take the pregame warm-up, which means he's out for tonight. Wade Redden will be out there probably for warm-up, but I don't think he's going to supplant any of the little baby bears that have taken the lineup by storm in the last couple games against the Rangers. And I would expect that Torrey Krug, Matt Barkowski, and Dougie Hamilton will all be in there again for Game 3, and maybe Seidenberg comes back for Game 4.
Well, yeah, and therein lies an excellent sort of coaching philosophy question, because you never want to... When you have a veteran team like the Boston Bruins, if you're Claude Julien, the last thing you want to do is let someone injure themselves out of the lineup. It's just a bad message specifically for veteran players. But then the dilemma comes when you look at, oh my God, Torrey Krug has 2 goals in 2 games. And look what Dougie Hamilton is doing with Char. And look how Matt Barkowski is playing. How do we take these kids out of the lineup? You know what I mean? So that's that fine line that Julien's got to walk when these guys get healthy again.
Yeah, I think he's at the perfect crossroads Claude Julien is right now, though, where maybe Wade Redden is not quite back to 100% yet, and these kids are playing so well. And this Game 3 gives Redden another chance to heal a little bit more and get closer to where he's at full strength, and it allows one more game to see if these three guys are totally for real and if they can continue to play under that kind of pressure, or if things are going to crumble for them and they're going to start to show their age a little bit, you know. I think that's exactly what we're going to see in this Game 3, and it should be fun to watch. When Seidenberg does come back, he's going to go right back in the lineup with Zdeno Chara, and Dougie Hamilton's probably going to end up being the healthy scratch, and Krug and Barkowski will stay in there. I will say this, of those young defensemen, although Krug has made a huge splash offensively and he's been an electric player, I think Barkowski is the guy that even when all the returning guys are healthy will stay in that lineup because he's been that good as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I'll send word to Pierre McGuire that Dougie Hamilton will be out of the lineup. I'm sure he'll light a candle for him between the benches. From the Rangers' perspective in this series, Hags, what do you think has been their biggest issue? I mean, is it the general answer offense, or have there been deeper issues for the Rangers?
Well, there's certainly the offensive issue, and it's demoralizing for them. And we saw this, I think, in the third period. When they go down by a couple of goals, they know that they just can't come back. They don't have the firepower to get back in the game. They're Boston, and people that know hockey in Boston and watch the Bruins are very familiar with an anemic power play that actually sucks the life and momentum out of the hockey team, and I think that's also going on with the Rangers right now. But I have to wonder if there's more going on there. You know, some of the things that are going on with that team right now just make you scratch your head, whether it's Brad Richards is a fourth liner and playing 12 minutes a night and being an absolute non-factor in this series whatsoever, whether it's John Tortorella saying that Carl Hagelin stinks on the power play and really, I think, aggressively calling out one of his players probably more than he should, whether it's I asked John Tortorella a question about adjustments between games 1 and 2, and he came back at me saying that it's not adjustments on the ice, it's adjustments off the ice, which I thought was a rather curious answer to the question. And you put all this stuff together, and you start to wonder if how hard this Rangers team at times is playing for Tortorella and whether they've kind of tuned him out a little bit. I think it's a fair and legitimate question when you start to see some of the things going on. And I'll go one step further. This series almost reminds me of a couple of years ago when the Bruins played the Flyers and played a team that was supposed to be good, swept them in four games, and we find out after the fact Dry Island and all these other issues going on inside that dressing room. I almost wonder, after watching these first couple of games, whether there's something like that going on with the Rangers, because there were some things in Game 2 that really surprised me when I was watching that team.
You know, and tonight at MSG, first two games in Boston, of course, Claude Julien has the last change, so every time 61 is out there, jump over the boards, here comes number 33. Yep. How does Claude Julien now adjust, knowing that it'll be a little bit easier for John Tortorella to get Rick Nash away from Zdeno Chara?
Yeah, that's going to be one of the keys, right? And I think that's something they tried to do at times in the games in Boston. And I think it's something where they're just going to have trust in the other guys. They're going to do the best they can to maybe split up the pairings. And what they've always done in the past is, especially at the beginning of the game and on faceoffs, they'll put Adam McQuaid and Zdeno Chara out there. And then they'll go one way or the other depending on who they the Rangers throw on the ice. If it's one of the lower lines, they'll have Chara jump right back over the boards and put out Torrey Krug in this case. And if it's 61 that's out there, you'll see Dougie Hamilton come over the boards. Or maybe they'll just stay with McQuaid in that situation with Zdeno Chara out there. I mean, you'll see some games being played like that. But the bottom line is John Tortorella and the Rangers will get some advantageous matchups in these games at Madison Square Garden where Nash is going to be out there. And as you saw in Game 2 on the goal that he scored, he even gave Zdeno Chara and Dougie Hamilton problems. I mean, I think that pairing, they can attack Dougie Hamilton on the other side from Chara. They were on the ice for both of the goals scored for New York, and I think Hamilton at times was caught in between, wasn't physical enough, still showing some of that 19-year-old rookie tendencies to get lost a little bit defensively, and that's something the Rangers can certainly attack if he's back in there again tonight.
Overall, how would you assess Tuukka Rask in these playoffs? I mean, I think everybody was sort of curious how he would play, this being, you know, him getting the reins for this team after the way Timmy played for them in the postseason. How do you feel he's fared in the playoffs?
I thought he outplayed James Reimer in the first round, even though Reimer had a good game five and was at times solid in that series against the Bruins. And he's doing the same thing with Lundqvist right now. You know, Lundqvist is certainly not getting much help from his defense. Michael Delzato and Dan Girardi were absolutely hard in that game, too. I would expect they're going to break those two up tonight, and it's going to be McDonough and Girardi together in the shutdown pairing that was so effective against Ovechkin in the first round against Washington. And, you know, maybe it'll be a little bit better in front of him. But all that being said, Lundqvist was a guy that I thought has seen a lot of the shots that the Bruins have fired on him and hasn't been able to stop them. There's been some eyebrow-raising goals that he's given up, whereas on the other side, Tuukka Rask was the reason that they won that game, too, when the Rangers had 16 shots on net in the second period, including a bunch of odd man rushes, and Rask was able to stop all those shots and keep the Rangers off the board and really, I think, frustrate them and allow the Bruins to counterattack and take that victory. You know, Rask has been everything they could have asked for, and he continues to show that he is the number one goaltender and that he's the franchise guy that is going to earn beaucoup bucks from the Bruins after the season's over.
You know, one of the big stories coming off of Game 2, of course, the shoulder injury to Henrik Lundqvist. Yesterday he said he's good to go. He'll start tonight for the New York Rangers. I think there's a better chance of Eddie Jockeman or Mike Richter starting than Martin Biron. But having said that, knowing that Lundqvist is in there with the bad wing, does that mean the MO tonight is to shoot high on Lundqvist?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the Bruins' MO anyway, usually with goaltenders, is to challenge high. You want to get stuff right under the bar. And they're going to continue to try to do that. But for them, it's not about, I think, changing as much as it's about continuing to try to get as much traffic as, in front of him as possible. And the one thing that they've talked about, you saw this with the goal that Lucic scored at the end of the third period, is getting guys to be able to stop on a dime right in front of the net to hit rebounds in and to knock rebounds in. I think they feel like there are a lot of rebounds that are going to drop right to the front of the net against Lundqvist. And they went into the series thinking that, and they focused a lot on stopping short and sort of camping out right in front with the big bodies and getting to those rebounds. And they were able to do it in Game 2 somewhat effectively, and I think that continues to be the strategy, is to get the big guys like Lucic in front of the net to distract Lundqvist to make sure he can't see the puck and then knock rebounds in when they happen. One of the underrated things in this series, if for my money, along with the transition game that the young defensemen have been able to release for along, is the Bruins defensemen in both rounds have been able to get so many shooting lanes and so many shots on net. They've created a lot of rebounds and a lot of traffic and a lot of havoc in front of the net. It's a key part of their offense right now, what they're doing.
Last one for me, Hags. You kind of mentioned it earlier, but you know, there's been some scuttlebutt today about what happens to the Rangers coaching situation if they do, in fact, lose to the Bruins in the semifinals. Would you say this is the end of the road for John Tortorella if they lose this series, or do you think he'll get another whack at the pinata next year?
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously on the outside of that and don't have my finger on the pulse of exactly what's going on there. But, you know, look, the Rangers have underwhelmed a little bit and have underachieved. They've done very well during the regular season. They've built something up. It's certainly at a pretty good point right now with a lot of talented players. But for some of those guys, the window isn't going to be forever, and it's kind of now or never where they have to win and get to the Stanley Cup Finals, or they're going to have to, you know, make some decisions on players. And I'm of the opinion, I think John Tortorella is a good coach, a very good coach. Obviously, he's won the Cup before. But you still wonder if that hard-driving, shot-blocking, grinding style that he forces his players to employ, which at times I'm sure is not a joy to go to the rink and have to play that way to win, is something that grinds down the players too much during the regular season, the playoffs, where they just can't get through the entire beginning to end of that process. You know, a lot of people thought this might be the Rangers' year because the short season would help them in that regard, and they'd have more gas and energy and everything else and more healthy bodies when the playoffs started. But if they lose in four or five games here to the Bruins, how can you not look at the coaching staff and say something needs to be done, especially when you've got a guy named Brad Richards who's making $6.6 million from now until 2020, and he's playing 12 minutes a night, and he's on the fourth line. I don't get that one. Nobody's explained it to me. Nobody's really pressed anybody on what's going on there. I don't understand it. And it's really a big risk, I think, for Tortorella to do that with one of his best players throughout the entire series here with the Bruins.
And you think, too, maybe, and who would have saw this coming a couple of years ago when everyone lined up at his agent's office, a compliance buyout in the offseason for Brad Richards. Hey, Hags, last one on my microphone here. And this is based on nothing other than my eyeballs. Let me know if you agree with this or not. In the series against the Maple Leafs, Boston looked at times sluggish, at best slow. But against the Rangers, it seems as if the Boston Bruins are a much quicker team. Is that because, you know, they're able to, you know, get away from a bigger checking team that are the Toronto Maple Leafs, or are the Boston Bruins quicker than I give them credit for?
Well, I think they're quicker probably than you give them credit for, and I think they're finding their legs now. I think part of the reason that they struggled against the Maple Leafs was that hellish end-of-the-season schedule that I think really took something out of them. And even with a couple of days of rest going into the playoffs, they still weren't the same team. They played, especially with the postponements that happened and, you know, jamming all of those games in the very last couple of weeks of the schedule, they were a shell of themselves by the end of that. And I think they really had a hard time finding their skating legs in the first round. I was talking with Brad Marchand about this morning, and he said, I just did not have my legs in that first round, and it was frustrating, and I just couldn't get things going because I just wasn't skating like I normally do. And now he's starting to create and do different things, and he's obviously scored goals in the last two games, including the overtime game winner in game one. And I think he is starting to look like the guy that he normally is, and he's one of those players that is really fast skating and really brings the team speed to the Bruins. And if those guys are sluggish and slow, just like you saw and I saw in the first round against the Leafs, they're going to look extremely slow. But I think those players are starting to get it together speed-wise and getting their legs back, and they're starting to look better as a team. Really, for them, it was an escape from the first round mentality. I think once that happened, they were going to start to get some of this stuff back. But they had to get by that first round after March and April just beat the crap out of them schedule-wise, and they were able to do it. So it's going to be interesting to see how far they can go now.
Okay, I lied. One quick follow-up. I lied. I lied.
Well,
I know.
Come on.
One more quickie with Hags. He's good for it. If Boston does lose that game 7 to the Toronto Maple Leafs by a score of 4-1, 4-2, 4-3, or even 5-4 in overtime, what happens to the organization? Does anyone pay for it?
Yeah. I think there would have been a lot of people paying for it. Even though Claude Julien had signed a contract extension right before the season, the shortened season, the lockout year, I have to wonder if he was in trouble. Certainly, I think his assistant coaches might have definitely been in trouble. There was a very tense meeting after Game 6 in the Air Canada Centre visiting dressing room. Peter Chiarelli and the assistant coaches in the way back, if you obviously you're familiar with the room up there, they were in the back somewhere, and they all came out at the very end. And you could tell and sense by the vibe going on there that that was a very, you know, you better get your crap together for Game 7 kind of a conversation. I have to think, too, that there were some players that things were going to change if they lost, and there were going to be some nucleus changes. Whether it was David Krejci, who's got a no-trade clause that doesn't kick in until July 1st, whether it was Milan Lucic maybe deciding they had to, you know, move on from a guy that was is going to become one of the highest-paid forwards in the league starting next year, whether it was they maybe start looking at Marchand or Sagan after a disappointing series. There were going to be a lot of changes and a lot of things examined, I think, among that Bruins organization if they lost that game, having lost in the first round 2 years in a row after winning the Cup. And I think it goes all the way up to management and Peter Chiarelli as well. I think there would have been a lot of hue and cry to make changes there. The one saving grace for all of them might have been this, that the business of the Bruins is very good right now, even though they're losing playoff series. They're selling out every night. It's big business. It's big ratings. They're doing pretty well. So there might have been some hesitancy from ownership to really blow it apart because they have kind of a golden goose, a black and golden goose, if you will, right now. But I think there would have been stuff that there would have been ramifications if they lost that Game 7, for sure.
Black and golden goose. That's a takeaway for me on this one, Hags. That was beautiful.
Thank you. I like to weave a little poetry in with Merrick and Wyszynski. What can I say?
And they say North America has no poets. Guess again, ladies and gentlemen. Joe Haggerty, sir.
All right, Hags. Thanks for joining us, brother. We will we'll talk to you down the road, sir.
Thanks, Hags. Good voice, Hags.
Black and gold goose. Black and golden goose. That's good.
Black and golden goose.
Yep.
Justin R.O. writes in Blue Jackets Army. Does Lumbus get a free pass on Fan Army because they are a military-esque team name mascot? Or do they get a pass because I've never actually met a Jackets fan? Not my fault. I've only been to Penn's games at Nationwide Arena.
I don't know if they get
a pass, to be honest with you, because as you know, Merrick, although they've shifted the mascot and name and all of the accoutrements to a militaristic vibe, the origins of the name are a fictional bug, the Blue Jacket. So right. A fictional Civil War era bug. And I don't think that could be ignored.
They really do push the military theme, though.
Well, they have a cannon for Christ's
sake. Dude, it's a cannon that goes off when you score a goal.
most paranoid fan base is the question of the day. Susan Natan writes in, I was discussing this with the hockey rodent because he told me before the playoffs started that the Eastern Conference final would be the Leafs and the Pens. I said, oh, great. Then it will feature the two most paranoid fan bases in hockey, which I then modified because they are really the two most paranoid in the East. In the West, you have the Wings and the Canucks. But overall, I have to give it to the Penguins fans. I mean, I understand they've had some tough times pre-Mario. The few fans that attended wore bags over their heads and then the bankruptcy. But then they've also won a few cups, and out of the wreckage of the franchise this last time, they got a great team. But all they do is complain that they can't get every single player they want and claim that the NHL is out to get them when they lose or don't win by more than 2 goals. Really, if the NHL is out to get the Pens, I'd love to see what they do to a team that they actually like.
Oh, Canucks fan in San Francisco, by the way. Canucks fan in SF tweets in, ugh. Another QOD that's a gateway to bash the Canucks. That wasn't the idea going into this one.
That wasn't it at all.
That wasn't. That was not. This isn't a gateway to bash the Canucks.
Brian Massametti writes in, gents, I've been a longtime Habs fan, and I've always tried to distance myself from the general fan base. They are straight crazy. Everyone is always out to get them, the league, the refs, other teams, everyone. It makes it nearly impossible to have a conversation, listen to the radio, read an article or whatever without seeing a tremendous amount of bias and general insanity. He must read a lot of Jack Todd now that I think about it. But, you know, we got a sniff of that during the Patchy Ready thing, I think, right?
A sniff? They're calling 911. They're calling the police. It was the biggest overreaction to I shouldn't say the big, one of the biggest overreactions I've ever seen to something that happened on the ice. But with Montreal, though, that's cultural, and that goes back to the days when it was, and I guess they still are now with the Nordiques gone, the lone French-Canadian team against an NHL of Anglophones. And so there was that in their minds, okay? And we saw this in 1955 with the Maurice Richard riots. There was that them versus us and the NHL is out to screw us and all French-Canadian hockey players. Mm. There was that. When really, if you want to look at who the NHL screwed, it was a guy named Eddie Livingston, who used to own the Toronto franchise in the NHA, which is the forerunner to the NHL. What they did wish, because they wanted this guy, they wanted Eddie Livingston out of the NHA, what they did was they couldn't kick him out by way of the Constitution. So what they do, they just started a new league without him. And that's what became the NHL in 1917. The forerunner was the NHA. All those owners said, you know what, we can't get rid of them, but we'll take the rules, we'll take the Constitution, we'll take the teams, and we'll just start our own league, but Eddie can't play. So well, really, like it's Toronto that got chumped.
That's like what happened with the Belfast Giants when they found out that their new owner was a pedo. They went around and just everybody moved into a different team. That was now the Belfast Giants, and then the smoldering carcass of the old Belfast Giants was owned by this guy. It's crazy. Paranoid fan bases, Vinny Piccolo. I say this as a fan. The Islanders. Really? Think at some point you have to draw a line in the sand between paranoid and inferiority complex. I think the Islanders is an inferiority complex. I don't think they're that paranoid.
Do you think that's what the Maple Leafs fans have? Or is that an arrogant fan base?
I think it's an inferiority complex. I don't think they're paranoid.
I think so, too.
They have a different paranoia, which is an impending dread and fear. Like,
yes,
Capitals
they're
fans
waiting.
Have paranoia, too, but they're paranoid because they're just waiting for the rug to be pulled out from under them.
Yes, that's right. Leafs fans are like, you know, Charlie Brown kicked the football.
Right,
that's
exactly.
That's what Maple Leafs fans are like.
Yeah.
They're just
they
waiting.
Charlie
they know
Brown
it's going to happen.
Paranoia. Yeah.
Yes, correct.
Okay, very good. Mike Vellucci, any fans of any Canadian team or small market team thinking the league is out to get them? Which, again, is like an inferiority complex, but at the same time, I do believe there is an undercurrent of paranoia in Canada about how the National Hockey League is working to make sure that no Canadian teams get in the Stanley Cup final. Would you agree?
There's a paranoia about that?
Yeah, I do.
I think the NHL, don't you think the NHL would love it? I know every member of the Players Association would if the Toronto Maple Leafs were in there. For the gates that would produce?
You would think
so. Like,
think
about this. If you're a member of the National Hockey League Players Association and you're out of the playoffs, which team do you want to do well?
Toronto.
Bingo, because more money, they make more money than any other franchise, and that reduces the cost of escrow.
Right.
So if you're an NHLer who's not in the playoffs, you're cheering like crazy for the Maple Leafs to have a long run. Every game goes seven, every series goes seven, and the Maple Leafs to have a long run and maybe win the entire thing. Because as that pot grows, your escrow shrinks. And as that pot grows, so does the NHL's piece of the pie. You don't think the NHL would want one of these Canadian teams in the Stanley Cup final? Now, they would also want, thank you very much, for way of television, a significant market in the United States. But I can't find any evidence that points to the fact they're actively trying to, you know, persuade people to make sure this happens.
That's why I think they want certain Canadian teams in the finals. I don't think they want Ottawa in the finals. I don't think they want Calgary or Edmonton in the finals. They want Montreal.
Yeah, it wouldn't be the best.
And I think they were okay with Vancouver.
But the thing is, that doesn't mean that they're out to get them. Like, from a preferred business point of view, you want your large market teams in the Stanley Cup final. You want large revenue, big eyeball teams in the Stanley Cup final. Ottawa's not going to make as much money as Toronto or Montreal. True. Edmonton's not going to produce as much money as Vancouver. That's true. But I don't think it's something that they're, you know, actively trying to, you know, not actively trying to sabotage smaller market teams.
No. I don't think so either. Harry Kane, the Senators example, Eugene Melnick as David Caruso in CSI Canada. Lyerly, other than a brief attempt at competition from Ottawa this year, Montreal has this one hands down. Police investigations. Puck and Hostile writes in, the Canucks by far, always defensive and demanding undue attention. The Blues are slowly creeping up, though. I've seen the Blues mentioned in a couple
Blues?
Places about paranoia. I was kind of surprised by that. I didn't realize that was a thing, yeah.
Maybe I'm too far away from it, but I don't see that at all. It's like I don't see, you know, Los Angeles Kings paranoia.
I don't see St. Louis Blues paranoia.
Do you?
I don't see Blues paranoia, but I've seen Kings paranoia for sure.
You have?
Oh God, yeah. During the final last year, when things would go sideways in those games, obviously they don't want the West Coast team to win because of the East Coast. Obviously Andre Kopitar doesn't get a Selke nomination because they hate California. I mean, come on, right?
You do have poopy pants on today.
That's true. Well, it was a rough morning.
You're angry today.
Lowell writes in, the most paranoid fan base has to be the Washington Capitals. They believe the NHL conspires against them. Random Penguin, Michael Civic. I don't think the Capitals are that paranoid per se. Maybe on certain calls, I don't know, but like not overall. Like, why would a Capitals fan think that the NHL wouldn't want them to do well?
It's got one of their marquee marketable players.
Yeah, they're
an
East Coast
team.
Franchise. I mean, there's every reason why the NHL would want them to do well, I think. Lexi writes in, us Pens fans are batshit crazy and overreact to well everything. We're not paranoid. We fear no one. That's a good point.
You can't be paranoid if you're a Pittsburgh fan. After that lottery, you can't be paranoid. You're right. You're right, Wish.
Yeah, I know, right? Justin Sully, from an Islanders fan, we are extremely paranoid. Every missed call is more evidence the league wants the franchise to fail forever. By the way, on missed calls, I will say that we've seen a couple people mention the most paranoid fan base is whoever plays Pittsburgh. And I think that there's merit to that, don't you?
Whomever plays Pittsburgh, because no matter what happens, it's always the NHL wants the Penguins and Sidney Crosby to do well?
Yes.
Because the game is rigged. They always want Crosby in.
I don't care if you're the Islanders, the Senators, the Bruins, the Rangers. I don't care who you are, Flyers. There is always going to be a moment when your team is in a playoff series with Pittsburgh when you say to yourself, there's obviously a reason we didn't get that break. And it's because they have the poster boy. Right?
Look, Crosby just hooked that guy. No call. Of course.
Yep.
Of course there's no call.
Exactly.
You put your arm up in 87.
even though you don't have like the live and die loyalty to a team, you just completely captured what it is like when you believe the league is in the pocket of your opponent. It's not throwing a glass against the wall. It's not burning your jersey in effigy. It's that moment where you stare at the television, you see the referee's arm go up, and you say to yourself, "Of course."
Of course it's going.
Right? That's just it.
Of course,
you're just like,
of course we're getting the call.
Because that's of course, because he's Sidney Crosby. That's exactly what it is. And it is that is the baseline paranoia for every hockey fan that watches the NHL, is that you're convinced that one moment that the league is trying to manipulate the series to the benefit of your opponent, you see some shit go down, and you're just like, of course. Right.
And there's
obviously, because there's 2 minutes left in the third period, and they're down a goal, of course.
They've handed Terry Gregson, head of officiating, a secret sheet of paper instructing how you're going to make sure the Pittsburgh Penguins get to the Stanley Cup final and win the Stanley Cup. Oh, by the way, speaking of coaches and Quentin, Joel Quenneville last night came out and slammed the officials for blowing the call. I understand that. It was a blown call. And there's always been a hue and cry for officials to make themselves available post-game for scrums, for press conferences, whatever, to explain what happened during the game. Greg, wouldn't it be awesome if that happened? Not for the reason of explaining calls, but for NHL referees and linesmen to sit there and comment on coaching decisions. Like, would it be something for the referee last night? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Your thoughts on the Stahlberg call and the Andrew Shaw play in the crease. Blah blah blah. Spit out an answer. But by the way, what's Quenneville thinking out there? Like, what's Quenneville doing with that line combination out there? Would that not be the funniest thing in the world to hear a referee go at because it should be all fair game, because referees are always getting run at, right? By everybody, by players, by coaches, by general managers. I want to see referees make themselves available after games to hear their comments on the coaching decisions.
You'd be like, yeah, you know, I made a difficult call. It could have gone either way. But much easier was that too many men on the ice penalty that I called earlier in the game. What dumbass doesn't have his reins tightened on the bench and allow that to happen in a playoff game? That man should probably lose his job.
I don't know why that man is still employed in the NHL. We've got him three times a series on too many men on the ice. It is the easiest call for us to make. What is he doing out there? Does he belong in this league? Tell me you wouldn't like that. Love just it. To hear the refs finally go back at a coach.
I love it.
That'd be funny. Yeah, by the way,
I might regret that call against the Capitals, but I'm not the one flip flopping Ovechkin left wing, right wing all game. No, that's not me.
Which side is he on? Hang on, is it 5-on-5 or is it the power play? Boy, he must be getting confused out there. Adam Oates, rookie coach and all. I guess you got to give him a break. It's his first try.
Oh, that's good. It's so true. That's it.
Hey,
I know where I stand on that. I would like referees to answer for especially things like last night. I mean, even if it's just to clarify what part of the rule you are using to wave off that goal. I mean, there were some fans last night that thought they waved off the goal because the puck hit Shaw's glove. I mean, just a little clarification as to why the call was made. That's all I'm asking for.
By the way, if you hear a loud clap of thunder, it just got dark here real fast.
Ooh.
Up here in Stouffville and Troy. Yeah, we're expecting like major thunderstorms today. So if one of two things happened, if it gets like unbearably loud with thunder, or if I suddenly vanish and the line goes, we had a couple of power surges yesterday. That's the reason. It just got like really dark here. Holy smokes.
Oh man.
Trees are starting to rustle. Here comes a little bit of drizzle. Just saw some lightning off in the distance. Yeah.
Watch out.
Oh, yeah. Hope there's some more. Here comes the thunder.
Well, I certainly hope it's not the Independence Day ship coming to zap its super laser at the Great City of Toronto.
Yeah, because that's the first stop is Stouffville.
All right. We got a game four tonight, sir, between the Los Angeles Kings and the San Jose Sharks. Sharks, of course, winning game three in dramatic fashion with a Logan Couture goal on the rarest of rare, the 5-on-3 power play in overtime. Last time I've ever seen a 5-on-3 in overtime was probably the Capitals and the Lightning. And that was a series deciding goal for the Lightning. Very rare.
Hang on, we're getting hail. Can you hear this?
I can hear the hail.
Dude, I'm getting hail. I'm going to turn my mic around. Hang on, listen to this. Holy, can you hear that?
Yep.
I'm getting significant hail here. Holy smokes, this is
nothing lasts forever, even cold November rain. Don't you think that you need somebody? Don't you think that you need someone? Everybody needs somebody.
Hey, you know what? As a quick aside, Matt Sorum plays drums on that album. Heavy metal drummer Matt Sorum. How come on that album every drum fill is this? Bum bum ba ba bum. Go back and listen to that. It's every single fill on that album. Bum, bum, ba, ba, bum. Every song. Doesn't matter. Take your pick.
Well, there's one song where it's not that. It's You Could Be Mine. He's the driving force behind that song from the hit film Judgment Day.
I'd have to go back. Oh, man, this is storming a huge. Man, Claire and the kids are out, too. Oh boy.
You might have to.
They're going to the park to play Frisbee. Don't think that's happening.
This is exactly what happened the day after tomorrow. Real quick, because I can hear that there's.
I have to split. I gotta split. I gotta make sure the kids are.
No. Game four. Real quick. Game four. Your thoughts on game four? Kings and Sharks.
It's the old standby. You're never in danger until you lose at home. And God bless Antti Niemi and God bless Logan Couture. But the one thing that I think the San Jose Sharks did better in Game 3 than we've seen in the first two games is they got traffic in front of Jonathan Quick. And as we've seen with Quick before, as much as he's a good butterfly goaltender, he's also a guy that likes to get out high in his crease. And whether it's, you know, Joe Thornton or whether it's Patrick Marleau, whether it's Joe Pavelski, there's always someone there on the doorstep. And in Game 3, it seemed to be driving him to distraction. So watch for that sort of game within a game tonight. Also, you know what I'm loving watching in this series? Is we talked about this on Hockey Central last night. They're at different spots in their career. They play the same position, but they're on different teams. The story of Dan Boyle and Drew Doughty. Two guys, you know, separated by what, 13, 14 years of age, just controlling the play from the back end. That to me is a nice story they're following in this one, having a good time watching that. What about you?
It'll be interesting to see if there's any repercussions from some of the talk about Quick being interfered with in Game 3, you know, whether or not they get one of those calls, as we saw last night with Detroit. Those calls can be game deciding. I would like to see the Kings cut down on the number of shots Jonathan Quick is seeing in this series. 40 shots in game three. He had 35 in a shutout in game one. I'd like to see a few fewer pieces of rubber flying his way, than they have been in the series. But, I don't know. You know, Katura's a little bit banged up, which might, have some impact on the Sharks in this game. I'd like to see it 2-2 just for the dramatic aspect of it, but I have a feeling that the Kings might shut him down tonight. It's entirely possible. Oh, look at that. Jeffy's gone. Power surge. The message from Jeff Merrick is power surge. I got zapped. Well, we'll see if he comes back in or not. But as you can hear, that's the music. I hope Merrick's okay. I hope a giant piece of hail didn't crash through his office ceiling, landing on him. And that he's pinned underneath a giant piece of hail and he has to wait for it to melt. That'd be very sad. I'm Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports. He is Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet. Joe Haggerty is of Comcast Sportsnet New England, and he joined us on the show to talk about the Bruins and Rangers. And that's the show for today. We'll be back tomorrow going postal. Get your questions in the queue. PunkDaddyBlog at yahoo.com would be the email address. Thanks to everybody who chimed in on the question of the day, and enjoy the games this evening. And prayers for Jeff. Prayers for Merrick. I hope everything is okay weather-wise and that his family makes it home okay. There it is. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye. Thank you.